walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I think we put together a show quite fitting for Thanksgiving Eve. My first guest today is Ryan Tate, a Tampa native and the co-founder and president of Veterans Empowered to Protect African Wildlife, or VETPAW. VETPAW is a nonprofit organization that employs military veterans to train and support anti-poaching efforts in collaboration with African nations and organizations, in other words, seeking to protect elephants and rhinos against poachers. Later in the show, we'll speak briefly with Michelle LaFleur, co-founder of Thanks Vegan, the vegan potluck extravaganza now in its ninth year and open to all who'd like to attend, that will be held tomorrow, Thanksgiving Day, at Unitarian Universalist Church of Tampa. Also towards the end of the program is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Stras Center on December 18th. Now, for our opening animal song, I chose something highly relevant for our imminent conversation with Ryan Tate about poaching, particularly elephants and rhinos. This is Adrian Belew with a special acoustic version of The Lone Rhinoceros Now on Talking Animals.
I stand alone in my concrete cell, where people stare and toss me coke cans. I guess it's better than being poached, but I'd give my horn just to see my homeland. I'm a lone rhinoceros. There ain't one hell of a lot of us. Lone rhinoceros. There ain't one hell of a lot of us left in this world. They say I am ugly, call me a beast. I hear them snicker when I'm half asleep. Is beauty such a big commodity? I always heard it was only so. I know the zoos protect my species. They give me food, collect my feces. But I can't help it, I miss the past. I'll never again see my good old mud bath. I'm a lone rhinoceros. There ain't one hell of a lot of us. And I'm a lone rhinoceros. There ain't one hell of a lot of us left in this world.
That was Adrian Belew with The Lone Rhinoceros, an animal tune that has more than a little bearing on the conversation we're about to have with Ryan Tate about Veterans Empowered to Protect African Wildlife, or VETPAW. Indeed, let's get to that conversation now. With a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Ryan Tate to Talking Animals. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, Duncan. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us this morning on Talking Animals. So we'll, of course, get into VetPaw presently, but let's first find out a few other things about you, a little bit about your history, starting with the fact that you grew up in Tampa. What sort of role did animals play in your family when you were a kid here?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in South Tampa. My parents were always caring for animals that we found on the street or going to the shelter, the kill shelters, and picking up animals. My mother is an avid horse lover. She grew up cowgirl style riding, and I've always been around animals. My grandfather has a ranch up in northern Florida with a lot of wildlife as well.
Wow, so animals.
Yeah, I mean, nothing like elephants and rhinos, but...
No, but a prelude for a love and appreciation of those, it sounds like, so...
Exactly, yeah.
Now, is there a moment that you can recall sort of giving, you know, being surrounded by various kinds of animals, domestic, horses, others, that you thought, hey, looking back, this is when animals became profoundly important to you in particular? Is there any moment of that kind?
Sure. I think for me, my moment was when I returned from war in Iraq. In Iraq, you kind of see the worst of the human species. You know, or the human species at its worst. So seeing that, and when I returned, I recognized this, analyzed it, did a little overanalyzing, and really found therapy in animals and wildlife. So my wife and I donate our money and our time to local shelters until VetPaw came along, of course. So that was kind of the moment for me where I realized that animals are you know, what I appreciate, you know, the natural aspect of them. You know, they don't have guns, they don't have, hatred towards one another, and things like that. So I would say that's my moment. I mean, other than growing up in an animal loving family,
yeah,
that was a moment for me.
Yeah, it sounds like part of that post Iraq moment was really sort of recognizing there's a purity and innocence to animals that obviously was in sharp contrast to probably what you found out on the battlefield.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just a healthy feeling. Animals were very healthy, if that makes any sense. They were just they were pure. And they're raw, and they are what they are.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, you enlisted in the Marines as a very young man. Did you long plan to do so? For example, was serving in the military kind of a family tradition, or was there a particular catalyst that prompted you to join the Marines at a fairly young age?
Sure. So my grandfather was in the Army. He was a tank platoon commander. He's always he was always a big fan of military guys, so that was certainly made an impact. But for me, it was, you know, I was around Marines at a young age, and I had always thought about the military. And when I got around the Marines, they just kind of, to me, something stuck. They stuck their chests out a little further, they, you know, talked a little deeper. And so that made an impact with me. I just wanted to do something different. I wanted to get out in the world, and I certainly needed it too.
How so?
Well, I mean, I was a good kid. I was definitely a good kid. I think I was a bit confused in a way. When it came to my priorities, I think that happens with a lot of young kids.
Yeah.
So it was nice to get an awakening, and it really set me on a path to really wanting to make an impact in others' lives. I did want to make it a career, but I thought I owed it to my family at least, if not to myself, to kind of step out for a few and regroup and see what the world has to offer, and then go back in if need be. I think, though, looking back, that rarely does anyone get out and then go back in. I mean, it just doesn't happen. You normally get sucked out and you stay out, but anyways.
Yeah. Well, so once you had completed your stint in the Marines, what happened next? What sort of post-military career options were you initially considering?
Sure. So I went to school. I started going to school. And then during school, I got a job offer in New York City working for the U.S. Department of State. And it was one of those that I just couldn't turn down. And my wife is actually from Long Island, so it was geographically pleasing. And so I took that. And that actually set me up great here because you know, when I first came on to the Elephant Crisis, I was, you know, I'll be honest here, I was ready to go as a one-man team and fix this myself, which is obviously ineffective and dangerous, and I'm sure the U.S. Embassy folks wouldn't appreciate it. But so my wife said, you know, you work at the U.S. Department of State here. It's a powerful place. Go talk to people. Think about it. And that's where I actually started this whole mission and created a U.S. government proposal. Didn't go anywhere, so that's when I went elsewhere. But the U.S. Department of State was fantastic. It really helped me understand how, you know, while I wasn't a foreign affairs officer, it did help me understand how diplomacy works, and I have a true appreciation for it.
And so did that help kind of shape your pursuit? I mean, they didn't accept, as you just noted, the initial proposal, but did that help kind of shape how you pursued and sort of your strategy, as it were, for realizing the dream of VetPod?
Absolutely. I recognize the red tape that governments play when they go into another country in order to assist in matters. And being an NGO or nonprofit in this case, we can be, you know, more impactful without, you know, worrying about other things. We can maintain mission integrity while reassuring that, you know, we're not here for, you know, other reasons. We're here for this. And we can really dive into the communities that are being affected as well. I mean, it's not just the animals. It's the communities as well, unfortunately. So that creates a good opportunity for us to take a wide spread approach here.
Well, I definitely want to delve more into the red tape and just navigating around what I imagine, at least, were some significant sort of bureaucratic obstacles in making this happen. Let me first let folks know, though, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Ryan Tate, the co-founder and president of Veterans Empowered to Protect African Wildlife, VetPaw, which employs military veterans to train and support anti-poaching efforts in African nations. If you'd like to ask Ryan a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, Ryan, let's just make sure I have this sort of timeline correct. So you had this experience with the state. At what point did the idea of protecting elephants and rhinos against poaching come to you, and how did it come to you?
Sure, that's a great question. I actually love this story. I normally, you know, when I came back, I didn't watch a lot of violence on TV. And if there was anything showing animal abuse, I didn't watch it, not because I didn't want to become aware of it or educated about it, but if I couldn't control it, I knew it existed, so why watch it? But one night I was actually watching, this wasn't that long ago because the show's not very, you know, hasn't been around that long, but Anthony Bourdain's show, and immediately after, and this was in 2013, there was a special on the Tusk Trust, and so we decided, you know, let's watch it and check it out. And they showed a rhino, basically, with part of his face missing. The poachers tranquilized him and removed his horn. You can actually remove the horn the right way. You know, there is a correct way that you can do it without hurting the animal.
Yeah.
I don't agree with it, per se. But anyway, so when I saw that, it hit me harder, or just as hard, as anything that I had seen in Iraq. It was just so brutal. And I watched this animal wake up and die a painful, painful death. And to see that, you know, it was like a punch to the gut. It was terrible. And that's when I got, I was furious. I was depressed. I was angry, to say the least. And that's when I knew that I'm doing something about this. It was one of those moments similar to 9/11. I will say 9/11 also played a large part in my time, in my decision to go into the military, especially the Marine Corps. But that was, you know, the situation for me that made me decide to do something about it.
So seeing that documentary was really the proverbial light bulb moment where it's, wow, I got to do something about this.
Yep, 100%.
Having then decided to tackle this, I mean, it seems like one of those ideas that would be wonderful and lofty. I mean, who wouldn't want to help stop the poaching? But executing such an idea, given all the variables and international moving parts and laws, et cetera, would seem like an entirely different matter. This is what you were starting to touch on before, and I certainly would like to explore further. So without getting too steeped in detail, can you kind of walk us through how you proceeded from the initial idea, sitting there watching that documentary that day, through getting support and especially permission from the various nations and governing bodies to move forward with VETFA?
Sure. So without irritating too many people, I'm going to do my best here because I still rely on the Department of State when it comes to traveling. But being at the Department of State and having access to some top-level foreign affairs officers or ambassadors, I was really able to get input and information about the subject. A lot of, you know, public members of the public and media sources just don't see, you know, and that's in terms of, you know, a criminal network, you know, aspect and, you know, what's really going on the ground. So with that, I was able to analyze that and really think out the approach on this. And then I was also able to gain access to, you know, foreign government members that you just don't keep meetings with, which was great. You know, I had a lot of people stick their necks out for me. And I was lucky enough to be surrounded by a great team who supported me in this. And so basically I took this and I was looked at as some guy that doesn't focus on this. This isn't your wheelhouse. You don't know what you're talking about. Go away or we're going to talk about your career and what it may not be. And so when I heard that, and I specifically had those words said to me, I said, well, I don't need to hear that. So I threw away basically all my government time, combined military and State Department, and said, you know what, I don't need to hear that. I'm here on a mission, not for my career. So that allowed me and really pushed me the other direction. I've really been able to take positive or to take the negatives in any situation and turn them into positives. And I think anyone that's really found their passion in life, you know, if they want to be successful, that's what they're able to do. Excuse me, these successful ones have been able to do that.
For sure, Ryan. So just to clarify, so when those folks were talking about your career and your career path, were you sort of hearing that as, while it may have been well-intentioned by those folks, as an obstacle to getting VETPA launched in the way that you were starting to visualize it?
Yeah, it was definitely some bureaucracy. There was definitely some bureaucracy issues with it. And I understand it. It wasn't surprising. The other thing with it is, you know, we do stress the veterans aspect. You know, this is a program for me that allows veterans to get back on the front lines of diplomacy and really show what our veterans can do outside of war. Because there's so many other things that we do in this world outside of war. It's just, you know, war is popular, and that's what people want to hear about. So they didn't understand that. There was also no longevity to the program or... Yeah, they didn't see it as a sustainable program, something that they could do long term. And that, to me, was just, that wasn't an option. It has to be a long term approach. You're not going to fix this overnight. And they also wanted to take the anti-trafficking approach, which, you know, I certainly appreciate. And it absolutely has to be stopped. But there's too much focus on the Far East and Southeast Asia. And you're not going to change a culture there in 5 to 10 years. You're just not. And the animals don't have 5 to 10 years. So when I recognized what the strategy was of the large government, I realized, listen, we need more direct action here. We've got to get skilled men and women on the ground to save the animals. And it's also the park rangers dying here, too. So we need to get people on the ground to train with these guys, these men and women, and get out there with them and give them some support here.
So it sounds like, Ryan, that you might have gone a bit rogue here, but only in the best way possible.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate description. I think it's an accurate word.
Once you said, hey, the kind of official line here is not working for me, the timetable and the focus are kind of all askew based on how I envision this thing going and the kind of impact I want to have. So then how did you proceed? I mean, you still, and something like that, I would think at least, have to have certain kinds of permission and connections, especially if you're going to be in an area where there's a lot of weapons and presumably the VETPA people are going to be armed with weapons as well. I mean, so how, once you said, hey, I'm not doing the official thing, I am going to go a bit rogue here, how did you then proceed and still end up with the sort of permission and blessing, I guess, too, to make this happen?
Sure. So, I mean, I was able to fill my Rolodex with great people in Africa. Really, you know, the good people that are doing good things. I spoke with Tanzania's Minister of Natural Resources and Tourism. We met, spoke a few times, and he understood more so than the U.S. government folks that I spoke with, what our veterans bring to the table. The president of Tanzania was briefed on this, and he said, we understand this. We want this program. And so, you know, I was able to maintain those relationships. I told those people my plan, and shortly after, I spoke with them about my plan, and they were very supportive. I left. I left my job. And started this as a nonprofit full time. So I just was—I did a good job navigating the relationships that I had started and maintaining them. I left on good terms with everyone, and it really helped.
Well, so once you left, and once you had sort of presented your case to others that were obviously supportive in Tanzania, what sort of rules and laws were set down, kind of governing how VetPA could proceed, and I'm sure in some cases how they couldn't proceed? I mean, there must have been some sort of parameters set, given how kind of volatile and dangerous the whole poaching world and anti-poaching world is.
Sure. So, I mean, thus far, just because we want to make sure that we implement the correct way. You know this, and everyone I'm sure understands this. If you go over there and you push it too fast and you force it, you're not going to have a sustainable program, and that's going to hurt the wildlife. We've been in really a research mode for a long time, and now we're starting to ramp up and put a team on the ground in the next few months. So we went over and we've been communicating with the government and finding out the best way to get involved. There's a lot of NGOs getting involved. Which is interesting, and it can be dangerous as well. I mean, it has to be a unified approach here, or you're just going to be spinning your wheels. And so we've really been trying to enhance and not rebuild rebuild programs that are doing great things. So that said, we've been in discussions on how everything will work, and it obviously changes anywhere you go. So it's a little difficult to speak on how we do things, just because the parks are all run, you know, some parks are run federally, some are private, and
and you have to kind of adapt.
It's a different battle each time you go.
You have to adapt your approach, I guess, from park to park, case to case. And it sounds like, if I follow you for what you said a moment ago, there are other organizations that either do something similar to VetPA, or at least have similar objectives that you're teaming with.
Exactly. Yeah.
So to put this kind of in more of a context, although frankly probably a depressing context, let's talk numbers for a moment here. By whatever standard you feel is most relevant, tell me how many elephants are dying at the hands of poachers each year.
Sure. So, I mean, there's a stat out now which is pretty accurate. You know, they came out with a lowball statistic, and I think it came from an African source, and I believe it was around 40,000 elephants a year, and then just in Central Africa alone, I think they lost 100,000 elephants in the past 3 years. I mean, rhinos, I heard this a few days ago from a South African anti-poaching leader, and he said that rhino horn right now is the most expensive substance on earth. More so, and this one's one that people like to use, but it's more so than cocaine, but also it's more expensive than any nuclear substance in the world. And I haven't been able to vet this out too much, so don't quote me on it if it's inaccurate. But I haven't been able to find anything that proves it wrong yet. But, I mean, that's a problem. That is a serious problem.
No, it absolutely is, and certainly a lot of investigative stories, including there was a great piece a year or two ago in National Geographic that really, really looked into this very closely, and even then, the value for rhino horn was sky high, and of course, therefore, the craze to get rhino horn. And as you said earlier, you can get rhino horn without killing or even injuring significantly the animal, but poachers obviously are in too big of a hurry usually and just want to get the horn and go. So
yeah, and I do just want to be clear. I disagree with the farming of rhino horn. Even if it's done right, I just believe it belongs with the animal. And,
so can you explain that, for people listening who might not be as familiar with what you mean there, can you kind of explain what that is?
Sure. Absolutely. This is a great topic for me, and I'm very passionate about this one especially. A lot of people think that we can farm rhino horn and that we should to stem the demand. But, I mean, that's a pretty desperate measure, and it is desperate times. These are desperate times. So I certainly understand it, and I've heard it from people that are working very hard on the ground, in direct action to save the wildlife. But it's just not right. I can't agree with it. That horn belongs with those animals, and then there's also people that believe that, you know, well, what can't you just remove the tusks from an elephant? No, you can't do that. It's built into their body. It runs all the way up to their brain. Those are nerves in those tusks. There are nerves in those tusks. So that's not possible either. I mean, the bottom line here is that the passive aggressive or diplomatic approach of you know, PSAs in China or Southeast Asia, you know, and explaining to them why this, you know, they need to stop buying these things is not working. And we need to put direct action on the ground, and we also need to educate those in the communities around the wildlife on why these animals are so important, because it's their heritage, it's their well-being. That's my whole thought on this.
Sure. And so, of course, we talked about the number of elephants, either by year or the figure that you gave for the last 3 years. Am I right in thinking that the rhino situation, not unrelated, of course, to the horns being now deemed the most expensive substance on Earth, as you noted, are the population is so far gone that it's hard to imagine any effort that would really restore the rhino population?
You know, you're one of the first people that I've spoken with that brought that up, and I'm unfortunately I agree with those thoughts, that it's hard for me to imagine at this point if rhinos will ever be self-sustainable in the wild again. That said, it certainly drives me harder to prove myself wrong in this case, but yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah. Well, let me let folks know again, this is Talking Animals. I'm speaking with Ryan Tate, the co-founder and president of Veterans Empowered to Protect African Wildlife, VetPaw. We have a few more minutes, and we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So with that sort of, again, bleak and depressing backdrop of numbers and statistics in mind, what specifically are VetPaw's goals? I mean, how do you measure results? I know you said a team will be on the ground hopefully in the next few months, but are there goals that are numerical? Are there is there other criteria that's important that equals success to you and VetPaw?
Sure. I think that the animal numbers in the region that we're in, by monitoring those and watching them grow, I think that is one of the most accurate ways to do it, but also the rangers and the lives of rangers when it comes to direct action in conflicts, and how many of them are coming back uninjured or, you know, not, you know, still breathing, excuse me. So how many rangers' lives also are impacted here? I think it can be measured in both ways here.
Okay. Beyond being military veterans, obviously, what traits or qualifications are you looking for in people that would join VetPaw?
Sure. So we select our team based on, you know, not just their background in the military, but also their understanding of the situation. Because to be clear, we're not going in any country and with the goal of throwing lead down range or shoot, you know, pulling the trigger. If anything, it's the exact opposite. We're not here to create a war. We have the most experienced military in the world, and that's just how it is. After, you know, 10 plus years at war. So, you know, our guys are the last guys that would pull, men and women, that would pull the trigger, because we've been under pressure. We've been there, we've done that. I think it's those that don't have that experience that you'll find pulling the trigger first. But it's also, you know, so we look at their passion for this. They all write a paper and they tell us, you know, why this is important to them, why the mission or how they view this mission and you know, what they want to get out of it. And so with that, we just really look to find people that are in this for the right reasons. Honestly, your experience, you know, whether it's special forces or infantry is less important to me because they're all capable. This isn't a war zone. A lot of people call it that, but it could create war zones with the economic instability that losing these animals would cause. But we do a good job at selecting men and women that are very passionate about the cause.
That makes sense. So it sounds like the core VETPA personnel would be Ryan Tate-like, but people whose stories would alter a little bit in terms of their passion and their focus, but there'd certainly be a huge shared passion for animals, and again, specifically trying to protect the rhinos and the elephants from the poaching that obviously has just become just rampant there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can go all day on why this is, why this is important, the many umbrella reasons that we should save these animals, but, you know, we're just looking for guys, for men and women that want to do this because it's right, not because of the economic impact that it would make or this or that. Of course, those come with it. But this is the right thing to do. And so I can sit here and talk about, you know, to an American why you should care about wildlife. It can cause, you know, it's counterterrorism. It supports terrorism in the Horn of Africa and other locations. But bottom line is, this is our earth, and we've got to take care of these animals. But it's the right thing to do. I mean, when you really sit back and you think about an earth without elephants, I mean, that's just mind-blowing to me. I can't comprehend that. So, that's kind of what we're all about, really.
Well, a couple relevant emails, especially on the rhino side of the VETPA efforts. One is just some statistic, and as you noted about mentioning that the rhino horn was the most expensive substance on Earth, and not to quote you on this, this statistic notes that it's currently the 13th most expensive substance on Earth, with diamonds, LSD, and crack cocaine among the more expensive. Frankly, I would question that LSD would be more expensive at this point than rhino horn, but let's concede that it's really not the most expensive. And then another,
it's definitely one of them. I will say that there was a study, and I'll have to pull it up, that it does surpass cocaine, but I'll definitely have to look into that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, because even as of that National Geographic piece, I mean, it was certainly mentioned in the same level of value and cost even then. And that piece was a year or two old. But another emailer writes in the rhino, don't these animals need their horns to defend themselves?
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. I mean, that's a large animal. I mean, they do battle with each other over territory on occasion. They don't have that horn, they're in deep trouble. And of course, against, any other threatening animals. So, yeah, that's a great point.
Well, so Ryan, we're just sort of nearing the end of our time, but how widely is word out amongst poachers about VETPA? Sounds like, you know, again, the team's going to be on the ground shortly, but I'm sure word has been out that you're coming. Do you have any sense of whether people are poachers are aware of the VETPA forces being added to those that are already trying to work against poaching in those areas?
Yeah. Can't speak too much about it. I don't doubt it. One thing that I will say is that the bush telephone line it travels very quickly. And one thing, and I mean this in the least arrogant way possible, but one thing that we've noticed from experience is that when the word gets out that there's former U.S. military in the area, the poaching completely stops in that region. So for us, it's very important that we stay ahead of the curve and we find out where they're going to next. So it does make an impact right off the bat, except it pushes it elsewhere. So we have to really battle that as well and find the next location.
Sort of got a small flurry of emails here. Let me hit at least some of them. This one says, thank you so much for having Ryan Tate on Talking Animals. What an amazing mission. I had no idea this organization existed. I see these horrible poachers use helicopters now to shoot elephants. How does one stop them? Why aren't all these African governments putting their resources into stopping the poachers? Thank you so much for your great work. Now, before you answer, that may connect to another emailer who is writing in saying, I understand the need for diplomacy and discretion, but what about corruption and dealing with it in government and locally?
Absolutely. There's corruption at every level of government. Unfortunately, for the smaller governments, they're not as good at masking it. But that works in our favor. It is visible. We can see it. We have great relationships with the good people over there. We've spent a lot of time developing those, and it's something we're aware of. But that's also why, working side by side with rangers instead of doing it for them really allows us to navigate that corruption in any way possible.
Well, that's why I put those two together, because unfortunately, I think email number two slightly responds to email number one in terms of why, in some cases, governments there aren't doing more. Not to sound too cynical, but that seems to be the case, and that's sort of been borne out, at least in some investigations of the poaching and anti-poaching efforts. Let's try to take, we have a couple calls. Let's try to take at least one before we... Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ryan Tate.
Hi, this is Allison. I just wanted to call and thank you, Ryan, for what you're doing. I really respect it, and I so wish I could be out there doing it with you, but I'm just a lowly little nurse. I'm not a trained military person, but I sure am glad you're out there doing it.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, and I challenge everyone, it doesn't matter what you do, there's an impact that you can make on the challenge. Email me, I'll find a way that a nurse can make an impact.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, thanks for your call, and with that in mind, let me call attention to the website, which is vetpaw, P-A-W, of course, .org, and that also might bring us to one of our other emails, emailers, that says, hi, Navy veteran here working at the St. Petersburg VA. Just curious if there's any way we can donate via our paychecks or via some other just blank there to your mission. He's kind of likening it to here, the radio station, where we have sort of a monthly so-called circle of friends where people donate. It's automatically taken out of their checking account or their credit card. So is there something set up for that at VetPaw where folks could either donate, I'm sure one time, but is there a way to do ongoing donation if people are inclined?
Sure. So we do have some methods on our page, and people can certainly contact us at info@vetpaw.org. We have someone actively responding there. We have ways of working that out. For the most part, when it comes to places like a VA hospital, it all depends on the organization and how they do it. But we'll find a way. We're a nonprofit, so we'll find a way.
All right. So, and again, the website is vetpaw.org. Thank you so much for email. We're going to try to squeeze in one quick call here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ryan Tate.
Yeah.
Hi, it's you. Go ahead, please, quickly.
Yeah, I just wanted to commend Ryan. It's so wonderful to have a heart-centered approach. That's really important in what you're doing. That you have such a well-thought-out plan. I think that the idea of having the military there deterring the local poachers is just an amazing approach. It's so important that people are not only educated, but in some ways intimidated, because in a world of desperation, sometimes that's necessary, and the kind of gentle intimidation that you're doing, I think, is just an excellent idea, and I so commend you for what you're doing. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your call. That's a lovely sentiment, and a final note, maybe similar. One of our emails here also said, man's inhumanity to man is only surpassed by his inhumanity to animals. Thank you for your humanity. So, indeed, Ryan, that's for you, and we thank you. We've been speaking with Ryan Tate, co-founder and president of Veterans Empowered to Protect African Wildlife, VetPaw. And again, the website is vetpaw.org. Thank you so much, Ryan, for joining us today on Talking Animals and all your good work. And we'll get maybe a little progress report several months or so down the road and see how it's going.
My pleasure, Duncan. And I really, really appreciate you and all of your listeners. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. Thanks, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
You too. Take care.
In a moment, we'll have a brief chat with Michelle LaFleur, co-founder of Thanks Vegan. The Vegan Potluck Extravaganza happening tomorrow at Unitarian Universalist Church of Tampa, inviting those who may not have Thanksgiving plans to join them. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. If you've been following the Bill Cosby saga, you know that a pivotal figure in focusing attention on the allegations that were otherwise being ignored was the great comedian Hannibal Buress, who called out Cosby on stage. So I wanted to feature Hannibal today. This is a piece called Pigeons Get Murked. From Hannibal Buress on Talking Animals Comedy Corner.
Weird aspirations, like I really want to kick a pigeon. Because pigeons walk around like they're untouchable, like you're not untouchable, I'll kick it out of you. You're not waiting for the bus because you can fly. But I can't kick pigeons because there's always people around. If I kick one, some lady will see, like, oh my gosh, that guy just kicked a pigeon in broad daylight. And she goes and tells her husband, honey, I saw this guy kick a pigeon in broad daylight. Her husband tells his boss, my wife said this guy kicked a pigeon in broad daylight. His boss knows somebody at the paper. They seen, you know, front page of the Tribune. Black dudes are kicking pigeons. There's been a flurry of pigeon kicking going on in the black community. Must be stopped at once. Save the pigeons. Must stop these PKBPs, pigeon kicking black people. Save the pigeons. Acronyms are always hilarious. I don't know why I want to kick a pigeon. I just figured to make my day better. Somehow I kick a pigeon in the morning, something bad happens that evening, I'm like, you know what, that happened. But I kicked a pigeon earlier, and she was relaxing and invigorating. It's impossible to kick a pigeon, they're too quick. I tried different strategies. I tried to like side swipe, kick a pigeon and shit. I tried to punt one. I set up cardboard and act like I'm a breakdancer, street performer. And try to hit them with like a... But they don't buy that. They know all the gimmicks. That's why I want to have the Pigeon Kicking Olympics, where you get judged by the distance that you kick the pigeon, the number of feathers you kick off the pigeon, and the octave of the squawk. When you kick the pigeon like a high pitch, like, ooh, that's a gold medal. You kick out of that pigeon, you're a goddamn warrior. You deserve your own statue in a park, like, yeah.
That was Hannibal Buress with a piece called Pigeons Get Murked, taken from his album entitled My Name is Hannibal. Right now, to hear a bit about tomorrow's Thanks Vegan Extravaganza, let's welcome Michelle LaFleur to Talking Animals. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you.
So let's start with a bit of history. When did Thanks Vegan start, and what prompted it?
It started, this is our ninth year, and a dear friend of mine, Joan Zacharias, and myself, we're having dinner together, and we thought it'd be a great idea for vegans to have a place to have Thanksgiving together, and it sounded like a great idea to us, but, you know, some people were all for it, and some people thought, well, it's on the holiday, how can a lot of people come? And we figured, well, you know, if 10 or 12 people show up, that's who it's for. In our first year, we had over 150 people. And since then, we have nearly 300 each year.
That's amazing. I, of course, was going to ask you how many people turned up at the first year, but I would have never imagined there'd be that turnout in year one. That's that shows you that you guys were onto something back then, 9 years ago.
We were so surprised to see the turnout. And a lot of people the first couple of years would actually show up with almost tears in their eyes because they finally had a place to not only eat, but to not be so focused on, you know, the bird, but just enjoying food and being around like-minded people. They were so grateful.
So you expect around 300 or so, you say, tomorrow?
That's what it's been each year. It's been 300 plus each year.
Yeah. All right. So let's, for people who are listening who may not have finalized their plans or maybe looking at some options for tomorrow, let's kind of hit the key details of where, when, and what to sort of eat or bring if people are inclined to join the thing.
The keynotes, it is the Tampa Bay's ninth annual Thanks Vegan, and we just use the word Thanks Vegan for Thanksgiving. It's an all-vegan potluck, and for anyone that loves to cook or wants to bring a dish, that's an option. If you're not vegan but you're open to the option of coming, you can always not bring a dish. There's two different options. You can go that way. And it's being held at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tampa. We rent their facilities there. And the address is 11400 Morris Bridge Road, and that's Tampa, 33637. And we're still taking RSVPs until up till noon of that day. And it starts, we have a social where we just kind of hang out and have snacks from 1:30 to 2. The actual dinner, when we start the line, starts at 2 until 5:30. And the way it works is that when you come in and pay, there's a little number on your name tag. That means that's kind of what time you showed up. And that's how we start the line, is by the number on your name tag.
Well, that sounds very reasonable and very orderly. It sounds like you probably learned from experience over these 9 years how best to keep the lines reasonable and keep people moving through those lines.
Yeah, we've learned a lot, and we encourage people to carpool if possible. Can I give you the email address for the RSVPs?
Well, yeah, either that, or I was going to talk about the website, which I know is also where people can get more information on RSVP. But fire away if there's an email address you'd prefer. Sure.
Absolutely. No, it's thanksvegan.com or TampaVegThanksgiving.com. Both of those addresses reach the website, and there's also a Facebook page. And the email address is Joan. Actually, just go to the website is probably best, because instead of trying to spell it out.
Right.
And the website is the thanksvegan.com, and all the information's on there. Tips, information, you know, everything's on there. Address.
For people listening who think, if I'm not mistaken, that we can't get into the specifics, but there's, I think, sort of two prices. If you're bringing a dish, it's sort of one price. If you're not...
That's right. Yep, the website covers all that.
Yeah,
there's
so again, thanks.
On the website, so they can call and ask questions.
Great.
And again, this is focused on friends, family, and just gratitude for the day, and without the focus on the dead bird on the center of the table. And another reason we started this was, a lot of times when you tell someone you're vegan, they get a really sad look on their face, and they kind of gasp like, oh. You know, oh my gosh, how do you have Thanksgiving? And they're really concerned for the vegans. Like, my gosh, that must be a horrible Thanksgiving. So we try to, you know, get them to imagine the bounty of all the other foods that surround the turkey. And those are the foods we eat, just prepared in vegan style.
Well, this all sounds great, Michelle. And so, again, thanksvegan.com. Or, again, so many people, of course, find some information on Facebook. That I think you can just go to Facebook and search Tampa Thanks Vegan Dinner and reach the same information that way. So, Michelle, thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals. And happy Thanks Vegan to you, and all the others that turn up at the Great Feast.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for your time. I look forward to seeing everybody out there.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
As the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Strass Center on December 18th. We'll get to that in a moment here on Talking Animals. Right now, it's time for a few animal news and announcements. Starting with a little correction. Just got word that the event we mentioned last week, Temple Terrace Women's Club, is holding a rummage sale. All proceeds will be donated to Save the Manatee Club for manatee conservation. That's actually happening this Saturday, November 29th, from 8 a.m. to 12 noon at the Woodmont Clubhouse, 415 Woodmont Avenue in Temple Terrace. Our friend and Talking Animal supporter in all kinds of ways, shows, CDs, events, etc., Ronnie Elliott is going to be holding forth this Saturday night at the Hideaway Cafe in St. Pete. It's going to be in a configuration with Chinese Mary, which includes Rebecca Pulley, of course, another big Talking Animal supporter and friend, and the person who composed our fabulous opening theme. Also, Rob Pastore and Spencer Hinkle and Steve Conley will open that show. So that's this Saturday at the Hideaway Cafe in St. Pete. Forward to that. Got to at least briefly refer to this, because this is big news sort of locally and nationally. I'll read some of the story with a little or no comment, taking this version from Huffington Post. A Florida man is dead after accidentally shooting himself in the face while allegedly threatening to shoot a dog, according to reports. Police say Dennis Eugene Emery, 57, was declared dead at the scene after the incident early Tuesday in Pinellas Park, which is near St. Petersburg. Quote, he was involved in a domestic disturbance with his wife. Sergeant Adam Geisenberger of the Pinellas Park Police Department told Fox 13, during that disturbance, he retrieves a firearm, he produces the firearm, and he threatens to shoot one of the family's animals. Neighbors told the station that Emery's wife had 13 dogs, and the barking was a source of tension between the two of them. The story goes on from there. We will hit other items next week. It's the only other timely one. The Humane Society of Pinellas is doing a Black Friday special this weekend. And you know, a huge discount, 50% off their adoption fee for any pet that has black on it. Yes, eyes and nose count. So you can find out all the details of that. This weekend is happening at Humane Society of Pinellas.org, and we'll hold the others over for next time. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. And there will be a prize, a pair of tickets to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Strauss Center on December 18th to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. Pretty relevant to our conversation with Ryan Tate. It's name that animal tune on Talking Animals. And we'll take any guesses off the air because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. I'll be back next Wednesday, December 3rd, when my guest will be Michelle Raffin, author of The Birds of Pandemonium, a memoir of sorts about her years starting and running Pandemonium Aviaries, a conservation organization based outside of San Francisco and in her home dedicated to saving and breeding birds at the edge of extinction. I hope you'll join me for that. Please also hit TalkingAnimals.net, where there's archives of all past Talking Animals programs over all these nearly 12 years. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Happy Thanksgiving. And thanks, vegan, to you and yours. We'll catch you next Wednesday at 9 a.m. This is WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and Beyond Community Conscious Radio. NPR News is next.